Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, set the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about NATO, about how NATO came about, its function before and after the Cold War, say something about relations between Europe and the United States. And our guest for the program is Stanley Sloan. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a forum, panel discussion that's being sponsored by the folks in the Center for Arms Control and the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, talking about the future of NATO and the time after the Cold War and after its involvement in Afghanistan. That's taking place this afternoon on the U of I campus in room 314B of the Illini Union. So I think anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. Certainly, NATO was an institution of the Cold War. It was something that was created to counter the perceived threat of the Soviet Union against Europe. Today, however, the Soviet Union is long gone and the Cold War is over. The alliance, however, persists, leaving many people to wonder just how long the United States and its European allies will remain committed to the organization. We'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges facing NATO this morning. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He is a visiting professor of political science at Middlebury College and a visiting scholar at Middlebury's Roehatten Center for International Affairs. He teaches courses on transatlantic relations that take a look at the history, the current conditions, and prospective futures of the U.S. and European relations. He's an internationally recognized expert on defense and foreign policy, has more than 35 years of experience as a military officer and intelligence analyst and defense and foreign policy consultant for Congress. He's also the founding director of the Atlantic Community Initiative and is author of the book NATO, the European Union, and the Atlantic Community, The Transatlantic Bargain Challenged. First came out in 2002 and then was released in a second edition in 2005. And as I say, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
David, my pleasure.
I think probably it would be a good idea to talk a little bit first just about how NATO came to be and the functions that it was created to perform. And I think, and perhaps in focusing on the military function, I'm maybe simplifying things a bit because that wasn't really the only thing that was created to do. It was created, I think the intent was that it have some political functions, but I suppose the thing everybody always thinks about is the that mutual defense pact that was entered into by essentially the United States, Canada, and the countries of Western Europe.
As you mentioned, the original motivation was really to try to deal with Soviet power. But there was a not-so-hidden agenda as well, and that was to try to find some kind of stable formula for Germany to fit back into Europe after having been the aggressor in World War II. And the Europeans at that point in the late 1940s didn't feel able on their own to be the sort of the framework for – provide the framework for Germany, which they feared for obviously very good reasons. The United States was more focused on the Soviet threat. The Europeans somewhat more focused on internal stability. And the Europeans, particularly the British, took the initiative in trying to make sure the United States got involved in any post-World War II security structure in Europe. And this led to the drafting of the North Atlantic Treaty, which was approved by the original allies in 1949. And that I like to look at that treaty as a deal between the United States and Europe. The United States said, we will help you provide your own defense if you'll organize yourselves to do that. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans, in signing the treaty, certainly accepted those broad terms of the deal. The problem was that they never were able to organize themselves effectively, and so the United States ended up carrying a larger part of the burden in Europe than was anticipated in the original deal. I guess the other thing about the treaty is certainly the military aspect was the dominant one, and you've already mentioned the collective defense provision, which is Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, and that certainly was the most important operative part of the treaty throughout the Cold War. But The treaty is a fascinating document. I always, if people have any interest in NATO, I say go back and take a look at the original North Atlantic Treaty. It's an elegant document. It's very brief, very straightforward. Some aspects of it have been overtaken by events. But if you look at the preamble of the treaty, it says important things about the common interest shared by the United States and Europe. And the words that are written there could be written today. That's the part of the statement of the purpose of the alliance. Doesn't identify an enemy. No place in the North Atlantic Treaty does it say we're doing this because we're afraid of the Soviet Union, or we're doing this because Germany needs to be controlled. It doesn't name countries. It names values, purposes, objectives, and the ways of cooperating to deal with those.
It just seems to me that I start thinking now, or have started thinking now, more about the idea that while indeed this military security was an important part of this, that this more fits into the context of Americans who would say that peace and stability in Europe is a very important thing, and they could certainly say that, no, having just gone through in a relatively short period of time two world wars, incredibly destructive and bloody wars, with the idea perhaps that they would not like to see a third one, and that with the idea that they're having invested so much into trying to get to the point where they were to establish a kind of peace, that they would say that it's important that the stability and peace in Europe is important to the United States, and that they would see this organization as being something that would help to work towards that goal, so that it was a kind of a unifying mechanism that had a purpose that went beyond this idea that said, well, yes, if the Soviet Union attacks you, your neighbors will respond and we will respond.
Well, there was, from a strategic U.S. point of view, the assessment made by people in the government and outside the government that U.S. interests would not be served by any one power dominating the European continent, that would not serve U.S. interests. And so NATO was a response also to that strategic perspective, that by aligning so closely with the European democracies, the United States would be able to prevent any country from becoming a dominant force on the continent, force that was alien to U.S. interests. And so that was a major consideration. But the everything was very complicated in those days. There were different agendas all around. France's agenda was primarily its concern about Germany. The British agenda was primarily to make sure that it didn't end up holding the bag on the continent for continental defense. They still had a colonial heritage that they thought that they could preserve, an empire they thought they could preserve. The United States even had divided agendas, obviously, in the Truman administration that was concerned about the Soviet threat. But there in the Congress, there was a desire to make sure that the United States didn't end up taking the full responsibility. And that's why the burden sharing, the beginning of the burden sharing aspects of the relationship go all the way back to that original bargain when Congress insisted that the Europeans do most of the hard lifting, heavy lifting in Europe, that it didn't turn out that way. But that was the original congressional perspective.
Well, and that's certainly something that people in American government complained about for a long, long time. That is, that they felt that the United States was bearing a disproportionate share of the burden, and that the Europeans weren't, in fact, doing contributing enough to their own defense.
Mm. Yeah, and if you look at the history, you see, well, it's partly our own fault because we just became such a dominant power inside the alliance. Part of it was because in the early days, Europeans were too weak to provide the heart of the defense against a possible Soviet attack. And the United States became somewhat used to its position of being the dominant force. The Europeans developed what I call a defense dependence culture, in the sense they became dependent on the United States. And they could rely on the United States taking a lot of the burden because the United States had strategic interests that had to be served in Europe. So that was the nature of the relationship throughout the Cold War, and it was successful in that the West won the Cold War, if you want to put it in those terms, and the end was very successful, but we still did end up with this burden sharing problem that has carried over into the post Cold War period and is with us still today.
The membership in NATO has grown, and particularly since the end of the Cold War, and now we have a number of countries that previously had been within the Soviet sphere that have applied for membership. And I think that some people have suggested that what these countries are actually interested in is they're interested in integrating with Europe, and that for them this is a first step that looks like it's possible. And that, in fact, I think some people have suggested all the way along that asking to become a member of NATO is kind of like a backdoor into the EU, which is a much more difficult thing to do. But I guess suppose the idea is that if you can gain acceptance to this to NATO, that that's a good start. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I wonder whether even going back to the early days of NATO, was anybody looking ahead to the kind of political economic integration that we see now in Europe and saw NATO as actually a kind of a facilitator for that?
Let's broaden out the picture a little bit, because talking about the early days of this relationship, you have to talk about the Marshall Plan. Because the Marshall Plan was the economic aspect of U.S. policy toward Europe, and that was based on a similar assumption about the relationship, that the United States offered all of this assistance to European countries to help them recover from the war. But we said to the Europeans, you need to organize yourselves in a way that will most effectively use this assistance. And unlike on the military side, where the Europeans were unable to organize themselves, it was a European defense community proposed, but it failed. It's a long story, but it failed in the French National Assembly at 1954. But the Marshall Plan was very successful, and the Organization for European Economic Cooperation was formed, and that started to provide the cooperative framework out of which grew the European community structure, and today is the European Union. And so in those days, the United States actually, with its economic policy, the Marshall Plan, provided the foundation for what became today's European Union. So the United States was very involved not only on the security side, but also on the beginning of this process of European integration.
Anybody at the time or in the time since say that maybe that worked a little too well?
There have been some Americans over the years that have believed that that perhaps Europeans ended up getting a little too organized. In fact, even in the 1980s, before the end of the Cold War, I would go to NATO headquarters and interview people on the U.S. delegation, and they'd complain about how the Europeans had started the process of European political cooperation, and on some issues that would produce unified European positions. And so when they got to NATO discussions, there wasn't much discussion because the Europeans had already been over all the territory. And there were concerns expressed even then about a European caucus growing up in NATO that would divide the alliance. So there have been those kinds of concerns. And I have, in things that I've written, I've talked about the U.S. attitude as a yes-but policy toward European integration. We've always, the United States governments, Democrats and Republicans, have always supported the process of European integration with a big but that followed it. And the but is that the process, as long as the process doesn't divide the United States from Europe, doesn't create great differences between the United States and Europe. And so there's always been a qualifier on that support. And I would say today we've come to the point where, while in the beginning the United States was perhaps the principal support, provided a lot of the initiative behind was in some sense the engine for the train of European integration in the beginning. Today the U.S. attitude is we still support European integration, but we're more interested in seeing that level of stability and prosperity spread. In other words, enlargement of the European Union is more in the U.S. interest than deepening of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Deepening meaning pushing it further and further towards some kind of more cohesive state. And I think the United States is no longer willing to pay a price for European integration, whereas in the early days it certainly was. I think Europe has gotten to the point where the basic situation of basic level of integration serves fundamental U.S. interests. And additional integration, as long as the European Union can stay at the current level of cooperation and integration, that serves fundamental U.S. interests very nicely.
Let me just again introduce our guest, Stanley Sloan. He is a visiting professor of political science at Middlebury College and also visiting scholar at Middlebury's Roehampton Center for International Affairs. He teaches courses on transatlantic relations. He's founding director of the Atlantic Community Initiative, has written a lot about NATO, and he's here to take part in a panel discussion, Can NATO Survive Afghanistan? That's this afternoon at 3:30. It's sponsored part by the EU Center on the campus and also the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk a little bit, or you could talk a little bit about once the Cold War was, everybody agreed that the Cold War was over and we had no more Soviet Union, how people were thinking of NATO at that point, and in fact, were there people who were, again, primarily focusing on this idea that NATO was a military alliance and the focus was the Soviet Union? So were there people who said, well, no more Soviet Union, who's going to attack Western Europe? What do we really need NATO anymore?
There was a lot of discussion in the early 1990s about whether NATO was still needed, and there were a lot of ideas, some of them pretty crazy. And when the Warsaw Pact started to come apart, some people said, well, maybe we need to make sure the Warsaw Pact stays alive so that it will provide structure for the framework of relations in Europe, have NATO on one side, Warsaw Pact on the other. Other people argued that the European Union could take over responsibility for defense in Europe and that NATO could be done away with. And there were a lot of other schemes that were floated. But the governments, the United States government and all the governments of Europe, finally decided that they really wanted to keep NATO around, at least as an insurance for against things in the future. And they came to realize that one thing that NATO did was it provided a framework for military cooperation that didn't exist anywhere else. And even if you envisioned future military scenarios being handled by ad hoc coalitions, which the Bush administration was largely focused on at the beginning of its term, even if you wanted to deal with military security challenges that way, you would need something like NATO, at least in the background, because what NATO does on a day-to-day basis is it helps the militaries of NATO countries train not only at the sort of the hardware level out in the training fields, but also in working with each other in headquarters and in planning and so forth. And if you didn't have that going on in the background, forget about having effective coalitions of the willing, because national militaries allowed to go their own way, go in different ways, depending on that different national cultures, different interests in defense industries and so forth. And so NATO, I think there was a slow development of an awareness in the 1990s that you needed something like this, at least in the background. And then what happened? Bosnia, where when the former Yugoslavia was breaking apart, and there was the Luxembourg president in the chair of the European Union at the time said, this is Europe's problem, we'll deal with it. Europe was not able to deal with it. And it was only NATO that was militarily able to come in and bring an end to the fighting and provide the framework for a solution to bring peace and to the Balkans. And this, I think, was a shock that to many Europeans that hear something right in their own backyard and they weren't able to deal with it. And that, of course, gave some impetus to the idea among Europeans that they needed to do more organization among themselves to promote defense. And that led to the European Security and Defense Policy that is the main framework inside the European Union for defense cooperation. But even that European Security and Defense Policy relies on NATO being there. Let me jump back to the one point that you made about the new members of NATO who, starting with Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary, who joined in the 1990s, the first former Warsaw Pact countries to join. And as you suggested, now we've had more Warsaw Pact countries and former Soviet republics who have joined NATO. It was an easier first step than joining the European Union. That's much more complicated. The requirements are much stricter. But these countries basically wanted both. They didn't want NATO just to get into the EU. They wanted NATO because joining just the EU doesn't provide a link to the United States. And they believed that their independence, their ability to get out of the Warsaw Pact, get out from under Russian control, was due to what the United States did during the Cold War. And they wanted to maintain that link, not that they believed that Russia was going to invade them in the near future, but they still feared Russian power. And they didn't want to be subordinated to Russian power again. They didn't think that Europe was capable of providing that kind of guarantee and that the United States was. And that made NATO membership uniquely valuable for them.
You could certainly make the argument that it was appropriate for NATO to be involved in the conflict in the former Yugoslavia because that was, in fact, Europe. How much argument was there, or was there a lot of argument about NATO's involvement in conflict outside of Europe?
That's a great question because it was a great debate inside the alliance. And the debate actually started before there was an Afghanistan problem. The debate started in the late 1990s when, following NATO's involvement in the Balkans, there was a NATO's 50th anniversary in 1999 celebrated in Washington. And there was a new strategic concept for the alliance that was agreed at that time. In the drafting of that concept, the United States lobbied, and this is during the Clinton administration, lobbied strongly for acknowledgement that NATO might have to be used for military requirements that were beyond Europe. It already had gone into the Balkans successfully in the long run, and it might be needed for more instances of the need for the use of military force. Well, the Europeans were very resistant to that, and they made it clear in that strategic concept that using NATO for operations beyond the territory of the member states was an exception, not the rule. But ironically, after the 9/11 attacks on the United States, it was almost there was a transition in thinking in Europe. Of course, there was initially a lot of sympathy and empathy for the United States following the attacks. But there was also a transformation of thinking, and that when it came to the question of should NATO be involved in Afghanistan, the debate that we had in 1999 was almost totally forgotten about. It was agreed that NATO could take on this UN-mandated mission, the mission in Afghanistan, without any big debate. And so there was a huge change of thinking about where NATO can be relevant. And even though, again, going back to the North Atlantic Treaty, which I said is a very important document to look at, Article 5 is the article that calls for collective defense, and that provides that if a country is attacked, other countries should regard that as an attack on themselves and then respond as they see fit. But Article 4 said that the allies could consult together when there are threats to their territorial integrity or security. And it's really under Article 4 that the allies now are doing the kinds of things that they're doing in Afghanistan, even though it was begun by an attack on one country, the U.S. The fact is what they're doing is dealing with threats, the threats that grow out of the al-Qaeda, Taliban presence in Afghanistan, the threats of international terrorism, the threats that come from the drug trade that so heavily dependent on poppy growing in Afghanistan. And so it's under a different provision of the treaty, but it still has an umbrella framework in the treaty.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you the question that's raised by this discussion that you're here to take part in, and that is, has the involvement of NATO in Afghanistan been problematic for NATO?
It has been very problematic. It was a huge problem, a huge mission that the countries took on. Many of them weren't ready militarily or politically for such a mission. Militarily, even though at the end of the Cold War, most militaries in NATO countries knew that they needed to move from preparing for border defense to a posture that was one more that required force projection. Now, only a couple of countries in the alliance really had force projection mentalities, the United States, of course, and France and the UK. All the other countries, and most importantly Germany, focused on border defense, and that was logical. They were defending the borders against the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact. But changing the focus means buying lots of new equipment, changing entirely the regimen for training, changing the whole mental mindset of the armed forces, and changing the way that governments defend having militaries to their publics. So this process went very slowly, and by the time we got to the Afghanistan mission, which governments took on because they thought it really was a legitimate mission. It had UN sanction, which is very important for the United Nations to have sanctioned the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. But the country still were not prepared in so many ways and have found it difficult. Germany, for constitutional and psychological reasons, does not want to take on a combat mission there, and so they have deployed their forces only in the more peaceful northern parts of Afghanistan, where they don't encounter on a regular basis attacks and confrontations with Taliban forces, although they do run into violent conflict occasionally. And other countries have also tended to deploy their forces only in the north and to concentrate on the development aspect of the International Security Assistance Force mission. And this has created perhaps the most serious problem, and that is what I call a casualty differential. The countries that are in the south, that are in the area where the Taliban is the strongest, and are the ones that are taking the largest casualties. And so in particular, the UK, Canada, the United States, and the Netherlands, and a few other small countries. Estonia has a very small detachment, but they're in the more dangerous areas. They're on the front lines, whereas some of the other countries, Germany, Italy, Belgium, France to some extent, although France has started to take on some more of the more dangerous missions now. What's happened is that the risk and responsibility sharing in Afghanistan has really not been equitable. And to my mind, that's the biggest threat to the alliance in the long run, that you have this feeling that some countries are really taking far more risks and paying a higher, much higher cost, particularly in terms of lives, than other countries are.
We're at our midpoint, just a tiny bit past, and again, I want to introduce again our guest, Stanley Sloan. He's a visiting professor of political science at Middlebury College. He's also a visiting scholar at Middlebury's Rohatyn Center for International Affairs. He is an internationally recognized expert on defense and foreign policy, has more than 35 years' experience as a military officer, intelligence analyst, and also defense and foreign policy consultant for Congress. He's the author of the book NATO, the European Union, and the Atlantic Community, the Transatlantic Bargain Challenged. First came out in 2002 and with a second edition in 2005. He's also founding director of the Atlantic Community Initiative, and he's here visiting the campus to give a talk, to participate in a series of talks. It's a panel discussion involving him and some of the other folks who are here on the campus talking about NATO and its future. And questions here this morning are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that immediately after the attacks of 9/11, many governments around the world were very sympathetic to what had happened to the United States, and that there was this willingness to participate in the military action in Afghanistan. They felt that this was appropriate and justified. However, there was not similar support in many places in Europe for the American invasion of Iraq. In what way has the way that the people of Europe and some of those governments felt about the United States being in Iraq, how does that influence the way they feel about NATO and its involvement in Afghanistan, which is seen, I'm sure, as in a sense a kind of a parallel mission or something that NATO undertook in part in the interest of the United States? Mm-hmm.
Well, going back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Europeans were divided in many ways, but both the German and the French governments did not believe that Iraq had, Saddam Hussein had anything or much to do with 9/11. Mm-hmm. And obviously the arguments the Bush administration made were that, in fact, that was one of the main reasons for attacking Iraq was because of the involvement in 9/11, the development of weapons of mass destruction and so forth. And the main European leaders on the continent were skeptical about those arguments, and in the end, they were right as well. The fact that the United States and other Europeans, of course, tended to be more supportive, in part because actually the British assessment, then Prime Minister Tony Blair, was very similar to the Bush administration's assessment. And in both cases, the U.S. government and the British government ignored some of the specialized intelligence and knowledge they had within their own governments that perhaps would have led them to be more cautious had they wanted to be so. But there were other governments who supported the U.S. position, a lot of the new democracies, largely because they wanted to show their appreciation for the U.S. support for their independence. And I have a colleague who's a senior diplomat in Europe who observes that the Iraq War created huge divisions, not just across the Atlantic. He says the dividing lines actually not only went across the Atlantic, but went through every European country and even through all ministries in European countries. So seriously divided, not just the United States and Europe, but many European governments of a very divisive issue. And in fact, looking back on it, you can say that the Bush administration in general has perhaps provided or instigated one of the biggest crises in the history of the alliance. And it's an interesting question to me when people ask, can NATO survive Afghanistan? One of the things I'll talk a little bit about this afternoon is why did NATO survive the Bush administration? With the Bush administration, it's with its unilateral policies, with its dismissive attitude toward NATO, with its choices of missions in Iraq that were so divisive of the alliance. How did the alliance survive all of this? And I think there's some good reasons for it, but it has left strains and wounds on the relationship that will take some time to heal. And unfortunately, in terms of public opinion and parliamentary opinion in European countries, very often because the Bush administration says that Afghanistan and Iraq are both important elements of the war on terror, publics tend to reject in some ways their government's decision to participate in the mission in Afghanistan. And this is unfortunate because the Afghanistan mission is in some ways painted with the same black brush that the Iraq operation has been painted by. And it certainly has made it difficult for European governments to justify their participation and their sacrificing of lives in Afghanistan.
Yeah. I wonder if you could maybe do a little comparison and contrast between the attitudes of the Clinton administration toward Europe and of the Bush administration, at least the early Bush administration. And I think it is the case that you would say that President Clinton felt that relationship was much more important, and that it was important for the United States to have good and positive relations between this country and Britain and France and Germany, certainly those three. That was very important, and that it seemed to be something that initially, when he became president, Mr. Bush didn't have the same sort of commitment to that relationship that it seemed that President Clinton did.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Clinton administration was not without its blemishes in its approach to Europe. In fact, in the first year of the Clinton administration, the argument during the campaign that was so successful, it's the economy, stupid, mm-hmm. was carried over into Clinton administration foreign policy. And there were statements from the administration about how Europe isn't as important to the United States as it once was. The growth in trade for the United States is going to be largely Asia-oriented, and we're going to be more competitive with Europe. Well, this, after about a year in the Clinton administration, they found out that this really didn't work very well because U.S. and European economies are so intertwined, so interdependent, that you can't make that kind of distinction, that it's not a successful one economically for the United States. The United States and Europe working together make the international economic system work, even if the Asian players are becoming much more important than they ever were in the past. The U.S.-European relationship was still very important. And so the Clinton administration then got onto a more traditional track in its second, third year, and then became very strong supporters of NATO enlargement, bringing initially Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary into the alliance. And we're very focused on the importance of having a healthy relationship, particularly on the security side, but also economically and politically, with the European countries. And so, yes, the Clinton administration was very, very much oriented toward having good relations and maintaining a strong alliance with the Europeans. They, too, slipped occasionally into kind of unilateral kinds of perspectives or looking at the United States as an exceptionalist power. For example, Madeleine Albright one time famously said, the United States stands taller and therefore sees further than other countries. And many Europeans picked up on this as, you know, a little bit of too much bragging by the United States. Mm. But this was only relatively minor compared to the attitudes that came in with the Bush administration. I know talking to people who became fairly high-level officials in the Bush administration, I can remember their dismissive attitude of the Europeans, how they didn't have useful military capabilities and their attitudes were not helpful and we really didn't need them. And I've had some people, like I say, who came to play important roles in the Bush administration have talking with them on a one-on-one basis and hearing this kind of attitude. That was the, I would say, cynical approach that they brought into the administration. And that showed up in certainly in more formal and important ways. And after 9/11, when Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said it's the mission that determines the coalition, was a direct slap at NATO, whereas you know right after 9/11, the NATO countries had made all kinds of offers of support. And within 2 weeks, Rumsfeld was saying it's the mission that determines the coalition, which in some ways is just a true statement, but it was taken as a direct slap against NATO and saying, well, we're not, this structure doesn't necessarily help us that much, and therefore we're going to make our own arrangements.
Mm. Well, you said something that I think is very interesting, because if one thinks back to when that period when Mr. Bush was first campaigning for the presidency, some of the things that he said, particularly his now famous comments about not being interested in nation building, I think perhaps led a lot of people to suggest that he essentially would be an isolationist, that he was not particularly interested in being involved in the world. And what you say, I think, is very interesting, because what you're saying is if you talk to people who were in a position to advise him and then later on became involved in the administration, and you listen to the things that they said, you would in fact get a more true read about what the administration's orientation toward the rest of the world actually was.
Yes.
Which was not isolationist, it was unilateralist. It was, you know, our way or the highway.
That's exactly right. And I have a little story. After I'd retired from government service, I was on a long list of foreign policy advisors to Al Gore when he was a candidate, and didn't play any kind of important role in the campaign. But when Al Gore gave his most important foreign policy speech in Boston in the spring of the election year 2000, I was struck by the fact that the statement accused the Bush administration of being like a Bush presidency of being an isolationist presidency. And I sent an email to the campaign saying, no, you really have it all wrong. And it's exactly as you said, that, in fact, what you should be concerned about is unilateralism that they would bring into the administration. And so analysts always like to be proven right, but unfortunately, I would have been happier not to have been proven so right in this case.
Yeah. Well, we're in the midst of another presidential election, and one of these days we may well have a candidate representing the Democratic Party at some point. While the war and people's concerns about the war, that's something that just never goes away. That's always going to be there in the background. And I would certainly expect that once we got to the point where we knew who were going to carry the standards of both parties, that there would be a lot more discussion about Iraq and what the United States should be doing in the future. But we're also at a point here where people are very worried about the economy. A lot of people are not doing well. They're having a tough time. And it doesn't look like anything is going to turn around anytime soon. So that makes you wonder whether, in fact, that once we get around to having a campaign, that someone's going to say that the slogan is, it's the economy again, stupid. and that, you know, you'd have to wonder where foreign policy and this whole question of the role that the United States plays in the world and its relations with the countries of Europe and Asia and Latin America, for that matter, but particularly since we've been talking about the relationship between Europe and the United States, you know, how it is that the candidates are going to be talking about that and what another administration, whether that be Republican or Democratic, how they're going to approach the kinds of things that we've been talking about.
Yeah. Well, as we know, American elections, and in fact elections in general, democratic countries very often come down to pocketbook issues being the key issues. And it certainly looks like our election will, the competition on who has the best plan for getting us out of this recession that, you know, you can either use that word or not use it, but a lot of Americans are having a hard time. And I think a lot of people will vote based on who they think will offers the best prospect of bringing the economy back up again. And, of course, part of the answer to that is it's really not the president that determines that. It's cycles and business cycles and so forth. But there still are policy issues that and perspectives, attitudes of the candidates that will be crucial. Foreign policy, I think it still will play a role. There are a good number of Americans on both sides of the issue, more on the critical of the war, the Iraq war side, that will vote based on that issue, their opposition to the war, and with economic issues being secondary. And there are some people who support the war who will vote, you know, they're sort of hardcore supporters for the president and will be hardcore supporters of Senator McCain. But I think that it will be the economic issues that will perhaps provide the most important turning point. But it's interesting, of the three remaining candidates that we have now, there are a lot of similarities. And, of course, they'll emphasize the differences as they whoever ends up as the Democratic nominee. And Senator McCain will emphasize how much different they are and how much better they are. But the fact is there are some similarities. All three of the senators believe that the United States has to do a lot of hard work to repair the damage to transatlantic relations and relations with other countries in general. So Senators McCain, Clinton, and Obama have all said that very strongly. They've also all said that the United States needs to do more in Afghanistan and that the allies have to do more in Afghanistan. So in some of these areas, I don't anticipate there would be a huge difference in terms of the policy, the words behind the policy, and then we'd have to see how it's executed. The differences are, I guess, primarily on Iraq and how they would handle policy toward Iraq. And even there, Senator McCain, who says we should stay until we win, is going to be faced with the realities that the U.S. military, particularly the U.S. Army, can't afford to stay in the current numbers. And Senators Obama and Clinton, they know full well that it won't be easy to pull American troops out as fast as their supporters would like them to do. So there'll be a dose of reality for whoever wins the presidency will face the reality that something has to change, but it probably won't change as fast as their supporters would like.
Yeah. And certainly, it seems that the Bush administration has had this commitment to exercising hard power, and that they came into office almost feeling that it was somehow an obligation to exercise that power. Because they felt that the stature of the United States almost demanded it, and they felt that they had something to bring to the rest of the world, perhaps whether the rest of the world wanted it or not. Now, do you think what would you think about, no matter who the next president is, you know, given what it is that they've said, about these three people and their attitude toward this very question, that is, how does the United States go in the world, and what sort of relationship should they try to build with other countries?
Well, you know, sometimes people talk about how the United States is the specialist in hard power and the European Union is the specialist in soft power. Mm-hmm. The simple fact is the United States before all of this, before 10 years ago, had immense soft power resources. If we define soft power as the ability to convince other countries to follow you, to go down the same path that you think they ought to go, that's soft power. You don't have to force them. You don't have to bribe them. You don't have to convince them through your strong military power. You simply, the strength of your policies, your arguments, your values, leads countries to follow your leadership. And the United States had immense capabilities in that area, which we have squandered away on the Iraq War. And I think all three of the current candidates are conscious of that and know that the United States can't afford just to rely on hard power, that it has to build back up the ability to convince other countries to do things that are supportive of U.S. interests without forcing them to do so or without insisting in the kinds of ways that hard power implies that they do so.
Hmm. I wonder if I could ask you about something else that maybe not quite so much a NATO question as it is an EU question, but I'm interested in what you might have to say about it. And that is the potential of Turkey joining with Europe, something that has been up for discussion now for at least a couple of years and has proven, I think, probably both in Turkey and in Europe, proven to be actually very controversial, causing a great deal of heated debate on both sides on what the relative advantages are for both the countries of Europe and Turkey, and whether they should and whether they shouldn't, and particularly as regards Turkey, this question of its identity. Here we have a country that it sees itself very much as a country that has its feet in sort of planted in two worlds, in a mm-hmm. sense, in Asia and in Europe. I think a lot of Europeans don't see it that way. they think that it's not European and that it doesn't really have a place in Europe. And of course, when people in Turkey hear that, that gets them rather angry, and maybe has led some people in Turkey to say, "Well, fine, that's the way you feel about it. We don't want to have anything to do with the EU." Still, I think there is a strong feeling on the part of both people in Turkey and people in Europe that would have great advantages to both Turkey and to the EU. Do you have any sense of how that might likely work out?
Well, there are strong cultural and religious prejudices, let me say, among many Europeans about Turkey's involvement in the European Union. And some of these are well-intentioned beliefs that Turkey and the European Union would fundamentally change the nature of Europe and of the European Union. The United States' perspective, perhaps because we wouldn't have to pay any of the face any of the consequences of Turkish membership in the EU, has been, let's encourage this country, which is so important, and between the two worlds, to have its European foot firmly planted in Europe. And another part of the American argument, which is a strong one, is that here you have an Islamic population with a secular government. Isn't that a good model that we'd want to encourage for the future, to have to show that it is possible to have a population that is Islamic and yet has a secular democratic government? And so it's a huge, huge issue, and I think from the U.S. point of view, it's wise to say, you know, we support Turkey being a member of the EU, but I also understand the reasons why Europeans are reluctant, because of how fundamentally it could change the nature of the EU. Mm-hmm. But I think eventually they're going to have to face up to, maybe they won't have to face up to, governments can find ways of postponing decisions, and that basically has been how this one has been dealt with and probably will be for the immediate future.
Well, even if it went according to plan, this is the kind of thing that it's a very slow process.
Yes.
And a number of things have to happen. And so it would, even if it went according to, went on the track the way that it should be, we would be talking about a number of years before this would actually happen.
Yes. It's just that the Europeans are not willing to give that final commitment that, yes, Turkey is on track to become a member. It's Turkey is working very hard on establishing the conditions that are required to join the European Union. But the final question is not going to be economic or technical compliance with EU regulations. It's going to be political.
Mm-hmm. When we started, we talked a little bit about the beginnings of NATO and again, the fact that people will think about NATO as being something that was created during the Cold War to counter a potential military threat by the Soviet Union. And we don't have Soviet Union anymore, and some of the Warsaw Pact countries are now in NATO, and indeed some of the, as you suggest, some of the countries that had formerly been republics of the Soviet Union, they're talking about joining NATO. But Russia still exists and is formidable. Certainly it may not be, it does certainly have some military power, but if it's not a military superpower anymore, it's certainly an economic power. It's an energy superpower.
Yes.
By virtue of its holdings of oil and gas and other things. How do people these days in Europe think about Russia and what sort of relationship they would like to have with Russia?
The attitudes are very much dependent on their previous relationship with Russia during the Cold War. Those countries that were former republics of the Soviet Union, for example, the Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, are highly concerned about the challenge posed by Russian power, even if it's not military power, if it's resource power. And the Estonians, for example, have had some brushes with the Russians over a Russian war memorial, and there was a cyber attack on the Estonian internet system, governmental system. So there's a strong feeling of threat still in these countries that were former Warsaw Pact members or former republics of the Soviet Union. As you move further west in Europe, there's more concern about maintaining a healthy relationship with Russia. But there is, in general, throughout Europe, a concern about the tendencies toward authoritarianism in the Russian form of government, restrictions on the rights of the press, restriction on the right of free speech in general. And I'm not actually surprised personally that Russia is going through this phase. I think that should not be a surprise that Russia would go through an authoritarian phase before it actually could get back on track with establishing a rule of law that is more like what would be approved in Europe and the United States. But it is of concern because they do now have, along with the authoritarian tendencies, they now have greater power because of the resource capabilities. And so this has, in Europe, it has also increased concern about how Russia is going to use its power, but there are different attitudes toward exactly how we deal with that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We've come to the end of the time. I want to thank again our guest, Stanley Sloan. He's visiting professor of political science at Middlebury College, visiting scholar at Middlebury's Roehampton Center for International Affairs, founding director of the Atlantic Community Initiative, author of the book NATO, the European Union and the Atlantic Community, the Transatlantic Bargain Challenged. Came out first in 2002 and in a second edition in 2005. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a panel discussion. Can NATO survive Afghanistan? That's this afternoon at 3:30 in room 314B of the Illini Union, sponsored by the EU Center here on the U of I campus and also the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.